Hi everyone, my name is Connor Heffernan and welcome to another edition of the Boys You've Seen. I am joined by a man who puts the eep in creep, that is Jonathan Cooper. Johnny, how are you?
I'm good, Connor. How are you?
I'm good. Did you enjoy that intro? I've been working on that for a few days. It's been a long week.
Yeah, it's one of your better ones, yeah.
Thank you. And Johnny, what are we talking about today?
Today we are going to talk about, drum roll please, it is the last time we'll be talking about the 2002 World Cup for a little while to give listeners a break from it. But we are going to talk about the winners and losers from the 2002 World Cup, whose stock rose highest, whose went lowest, what could have potentially been different, where players potentially could have gone, who's interested in who, that kind of stuff.
Wonderful. So I suppose, yeah, as I said, we have done a lot on the World Cup, enjoyably, I would say, for the most part. I still think, Saipan series is a piece de resistance. Will we begin with, I suppose, winners and losers, whose stock has increased, whose stock has lowered? I think with Mick McCarthy, do we? Because after the World Cup, he's the longest serving national squad manager in Europe, according to The Guardian. And the FAI, as happens with Irish rugby and Irish football, immediately after a successful moment, gives him a 2-year contract extension. So I think, within the FAI, within Irish football, his stock has risen regardless of anything else.
Yeah, and funny enough, this was someone who I didn't consider in the highs and lows after the World Cup, or that we'd be kind of focusing in on, and we 100% should be. I mentioned on the last episode that he probably should have gone, and I still think that. I think that last campaign, having not qualified for the first two, was his redemption story. I think everything with Roy Keane, he just must have been emotionally drained. And we forget that Mick McCarthy took this job as a very, very young manager. He didn't have a very limited club experience with just with the Millwall job beforehand, and obviously being an assistant before that. I think that's a hell of a lot on a young manager to go into a fourth campaign, and given everything that had come in Saipan, etc. It was kind of like, obviously Ireland do this quite a lot, and we're on the crest of a wave, and we're on a high, and we just kind of reward that, and we get very excited amongst ourselves. We probably should have sat down and had a little think and decided where, Mick, is this really what you want to do?
Well, the thing that baffles me is the FAI are onto him about extending his contract during the group stages. So the Guardian reports, before the Saudi Arabia match, the FAI are trying to get in contact with Mick and his agent, Liam Gaskin, about extending his contract. So it's not even like, oh my God, we could have gotten Spain on another day. That was brilliant. In the group stages, they're like, we want you, not until 2004, but actually 2006. To what you're saying, Johnny, Mick points it to, and listen, I want to stop after Euro 2004, or at least let the contract run until 2004 and we'll reevaluate. The FAI want them until after 2006, after that World Cup.
Yeah, and even we watched that documentary that Mick McCarthy did. I think it was on the 2000, sorry, the 1998 qualifying campaign. And even then, he was talking about offers he had at club level that he didn't know if international management, he'd taken the job a bit soon. You could even get the sense then that he wanted to try something different. But I think his ego, rightfully in the end, would have been having not qualified in 98, right? But I want to qualify in 2002. I want to do that. And that was his full focus. And I know he had the heartbreak of Euro 2000 again. But as I was mentioning, like riding on a high and then deciding something like that, if they did it before Saudi Arabia, it's on the back of Robbie Keane scoring in the 90th minute against Germany. Everyone's like, okay, brilliant. We're more than likely going to qualify if we can navigate this Saudi Arabia game. Let's get Mick tied down further. But as you were saying, his contract ran to Euro 2004 anyway. What's the rush? Like, get through that, see if you qualify for Euro 2004 or whatever, and reevaluate then. Just seems very premature. And look, I think the people making the decisions within the FAI over that period and in future probably weren't the brightest minds in the game.
Potentially not. And I mean, there's an article by Frank Cann, and I think it's the Irish Independent, where he says the FAI will have to cough up an estimated £1 million or €1 million over the next 2 years to hold on to Ireland's hero manager, Mick McCarthy. And it's saying that, Mick could be offered 600,000 a year by a mid-table club in England, and that the FAI is going to cough up €1.049 million over 2 years to keep him with the Republic. it does seem like we're sort of caught up in a little bit X-y, and like they do mention, oh, you know, Brendan Menton is leading the FAI. You know, we'd be mad to lose Mick after the Germany result. And you're like, we always, always do this. Just wait until after a tournament, give it 6 months, breathe, and then see if everyone is happy to do it. Because you said, Johnny, like Mick McCarthy, he's at Millwall, then he's been at Ireland for 6 years. Probably is time for him to sort of spread his wings. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and like international management in the future could always be there for him. And it's not, obviously Brian Kerr becomes the manager fairly soon into the Euros qualifying. But I wonder, were they fearful that there was going to be people snooping around? Because, you know, that happens, like the hot new manager at an international tournament, someone who does well is usually snapped up fairly quickly. You wonder, was there a bit of fear that Mick was going to leave?
I mean, potentially. And like the fact that, you know, Frank Kahn is mentioning mid-table clubs in England could offer him a lot more money than what the FAI potentially could offer him. Sort of, yeah, and he's saying this is coming from inside the FAI. It's coming from inside the house. This speaks a little bit to that fear. But I think if we're thinking of reputation enhanced, certainly Mick McCarthy is one of them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think how he handled the Roy Keane situation at the time, how he got over it, how he galvanised that group of players to go out and get that result against Cameroon, to use that never-say-die attitude that we'd had and that unbeaten streak by the Iran second game in qualifying for that tournament, even without their captain, who was one of, if not the best player in the world at the time heading into this. It's hard to fault his rise during that tournament, forgetting that Spain were down to 10 men and extra time aside.
Apart from that one little you know hitch in proceedings. So do you want to go through maybe the starting 11? Because I don't think we're going to go through all 22 players with one obviously missing from the 23-man squad. We go through the maybe starting 11 and then some of the more impactful substitutes in terms of who, you know, really came out of this smelling like roses.
Yeah, well, like starting with Shea Given, like what can you say? He was brilliant in qualifying. He was brilliant in the tournament. He's nailed on to be Ireland's number one. He's going to go on to have an incredible career. At the time, Newcastle are one of the best clubs in England. Shea Given's an ever-present for them. I think he plays something like, in 5 years, he plays 38 times in 3 seasons in a row. One of them's 36, and the other one, again, is like 38. His statistics with Newcastle are phenomenal post-World Cup and pre-World Cup. It's hard to argue of how good of a career he had. The only thing you would say is he probably should have a few more trophies to his name.
Yeah, and I think...
I'm surprised the interest... Like, he was very loyal to Newcastle, and it's not like he was an academy player there.
Well, I was just going to say, what's interesting is reporting the Irish Independent, you know, before the World Cup in February 2002, where Shea Given talks about, you know, he had put in a transfer request in the previous season. And something that for me was so interesting, you know, was looking around newspapers, there wasn't a sniff for him. You know, there's little to no transfer speculation because he is with Newcastle. He seems to be firmly entrenched there. But in 2001, he's putting in a transfer request. I know this is I would have said in previous years, a different Newcastle to the Newcastle of today, potentially a more successful Newcastle. Obviously, you know, oil money has put paid to that comparison. But there really is no one in for him. And even though there is a lot of praise for him and a lot of people saying, you know, they did very well, did more than enough, you know, to keep the Republic in it. There isn't that like post World Cup, you know, desire to see him at a different club.
Yeah. And for someone who was like rated as one of the best keepers in the league at the time, a decent World Cup that he had, you would have thought there would have been more speculation around his future then as opposed to pre the World Cup.
Completely. And I mean, the only thing to say about Shea Given is that a local MLA asked him to try and stop bus attacks in Strabane, to use his influence. I know, obviously, he's from the Republic, but to use his influence in broader parts of the North to try and stop bus attacks on school children, which I like to think he did. I didn't follow up, but I like to think that he was responsible for greater peace on our island.
Yeah, I suppose the other thing is they were progressing to the Champions League around that era too, on that Newcastle side. So you could see why there wasn't probably as many opportunities for him to go to a much better. Like, he was never going to go to United post the fallout with Keane and Saipan, which in another universe when Fabian Barthez is shite, if he hasn't had that fight with the goalkeepers, maybe Roy Keane says to Alex Ferguson, go and get Shea Given.
And I'm happy you brought up Man United, because the next player that we're going to talk about, Steve Finnan, is linked with Man United after the World Cup. So obviously, like, from 98 to 2003, he's with Fulham. He will go on, you know, to play for Liverpool for several seasons and do pretty well, if I remember correctly. But he is linked in the post-World Cup with Man United as the man to replace Dennis Irwin, is what's being reported in the English newspapers, or pardon me, in the Evening Herald, just after the World Cup. It's reported that Finnan has impressed through Alex Ferguson, and that Alex Ferguson and Peter Kenyon are very interested in bringing Steve Finnan to Old Trafford. Now, other names linked at the time are Alexander Onesta, you know, Lilian Thuram, Javier Zanetti, and George Andrade or Jorge Andrade. So Steve Finnan, post-World Cup, is being linked with Man United. Obviously, this doesn't come about, and, you know, he'll go on to Liverpool. But again, showing that interest, you know, the Irish players have really used the World Cup as a shop window to a certain extent, and we'll go on to some of the bigger examples of that. Steve Finnan, potentially the one that got away.
Yeah, and similarly to Shea Given as well, he'd have been in the team of the season around that era as well, just before the World Cup.
Well, this is when we had like a gluttony of, yeah, we had a gluttony of right backs.
Exactly, and like, I'm, again, there's a few players here who I'm shocked didn't get moved on the back of that World Cup. It's kind of like, now we're so used to someone like Real Madrid, like James Rodriguez in 2014, Real Madrid straight away bang. Anyone who has any sniff of a decent World Cup, they're snapped up relatively quickly. It's the shop window. There's not so much the case here. Maybe it's because we're Ireland and teams aren't as in demand for Irish players. We've always said that, like, a lot of players like should have got bigger moves and could have played for like at higher levels and never got that. Maybe it's because they're seen as Irish and they're not English, whereas the English players get brought to that level quicker and get given a better chance.
Yeah, and I think there is potentially something to that. Like, there's a great article by Mallory Clerkin in the Sunday Tribune in August 2002, where he talks about, you know, the Irish in the Premier League for that season. And he says, you know, mostly kids, few men. And there is a sense of like, yeah, you know, there's some good Irish players, but like, I don't know if, you know, almost like, I don't know if we can trust them, seems to be the ethos or the ideas for some of the English players. And I think Steve Finnan potentially at that point is, you know, not necessarily being trusted to that same extent. And likewise, I suppose, you know, Ian Hart isn't really in the transfer market at that point, but he's someone who sort of suffers the slings and arrows of misfortune during this period. And the Sunday World in September talks about Ian Hart facing the despair of becoming public enemy number one at Elland Road, and he's becoming a scapegoat in Leeds United because of, say, bad unrest and the fact that they don't think he's putting in enough of a shift at Leeds United. So I think Ian Hart is one of those players. If Steve Finnan's reputation rises, poor Ian Hart's reputation at least dips a little bit in that post-World Cup period at Leeds. He's starting to get pelters. This is in the Terry Venables era, and he's being made out to be a scapegoat and emblematic of the team's poor performances. And I feel really bad because he's only 25, he's still relatively young, but he talks about being stunned to discover the hostile reaction in Ireland to his dismal displays. Maybe I wasn't so aware of what was happening with Ireland last summer, he admits, and then he talks about a barrage of abuse being directed towards him at Elland Road. So, I mean, the poor fella can't catch a break, like.
Nah, that's a tough one as well. Like, there's, like, he was such a hot prospect and probably one of the ones you expected to go and have a brilliant World Cup. He was, like, in the 0-1-0-2 season for Leeds, was brilliant. You talked about that goal, that free kick he scores on Barthez. Obviously gets the goal in the first leg against Iran, has a brilliant campaign going into it. And then probably we didn't remember how, I wouldn't say, I wouldn't say bad he was, but how much of an underperformance it was for him at that World Cup. And it's emblematic of what the Leeds' demise is kind of summed up by him then in the next couple of years, because his career goes down when really he should be only sailing into the peak of it in the next couple of years. And I've always said that about Ian Hart. He broke in so young and was so highly tipped. And you just think about him from about 99 to about, even 98 to about 2002, he was superb. And it was like, right, this fella, he's going to take the left-back spot. Dennis Irwin's now retired from Ireland. Steve Staunton's going to be retired very soon. This fella's going to be our left-back for the next 10 years. And it just wasn't the case.
Yeah, and I mean, it's bizarre because if before the World Cup you said to me, right, people are going to be in for Irish defenders, I'd be like, yeah, Joe, I can see that, Stephen and Ian Hart. Like, we have some exciting players. And people are like, no, the centre-backs, that's where the interest is going to lie. Because we'll talk about the famous one in a minute. But obviously, Kenny Cunningham, you know, does well off the back of the World Cup. He signed for Birmingham for £600,000. And, you know, in the newspapers, this is seen as a surprise decision, but the correct decision. Cunningham himself says, you know, this is an unexpected opportunity for me. The obvious attraction is playing Premiership football again. So he's someone who's able to sort of parlay his World Cup appearances and experiences into a good move at Birmingham. And like, I know he gets injured fairly early on for Birmingham around December/January time, there's talk of him actually being replaced, but he creates like quite a solid partnership with Matty Upson, who joins like midway through that season, and he becomes the player of the season that year. So, you know, King Kenny does really well in that post World Cup. Now, it's not a huge money move, do you know what I mean? £600,000, but it's the right move and it's Premiership football for him.
Yeah, and I suppose he was Mr. Consistent at Wimbledon pre them getting relegated and their money problems. He stuck around for a season with them. He's probably moving towards the end of his career. Now, I know he goes to Birmingham, then he goes to Sunderland after. But the Birmingham move works out so well for him. He gets, what, 3-4 seasons there with them?
Yeah.
In the Premier League under Steve Bruce. But again, it's not like he's like the young one coming through. It's like, what age would he have been then? Like 30 when he got that move?
He would have been, let's see, he would have been in his 30s. Yeah, I'm trying to think. Maybe mid to late 30s. Would that have been right? I think, you know, he would have been 30. He would have been 30 at that time. Sorry.
Early 30.
Yeah, he would have been 30 years old at that time.
Yeah, okay.
So, as I said, like, we have the high demand for Kenny Cunningham. Now, there's no demand, unfortunately, for Steve Staunton. People just sort of praise his experiences and his appearances at the World Cup, but it's not... there's no huge demand to sign an aging Steve Staunton, but there is probably a higher demand to sign Gary Breen. And I think Gary Breen is probably the person to focus on and talk about now. Johnny, what do you think?
Yeah, so obviously Gary Breen, the famous one where Inter Milan and Barcelona are in for him. Is it Inter Milan that he fails the medical, in inverted commas?
But this is the, not dodgy doctor, but certainly incompetent doctor, isn't that right?
Yeah, well... I don't know what you'd call it, whether he was competent or incompetent, whether he was just, he realised that they were trying to sign Gary Breen and said, nah, this guy's knee's dodgy.
It was, yeah, he later, and like, he'd been quite forthright about blaming an idiot doctor who failed his medical. So he was linked with Inter Milan, and I suppose, like, it seems sort of ludicrous, but, you know, Inter Milan obviously had the experience of signing Robbie Keane, you know, a few previous seasons. He was also linked with Barcelona at one point after the World Cup. Such were his performances. I suppose it is pertinent to say he was on a Bosman that year. So, you know, yeah, he had the benefit of being cheap.
Yeah, exactly. He was on a free transfer. And like, that goal against Saudi Arabia was an excellent finish for a centre-half. And look, he'd had a decent few years at Coventry as well in the Premier League. Didn't, like an obvious... no lose situation for a team based on the price, but then maybe just when everything was looked at, it was just decided against. Because obviously he passes his medical and goes to West Ham, but that doesn't go well at all for him because he only plays there for a season.
No, and I mean, he was at the time, according to the Evening Herald, playing under his mentor, Glenn Roeder. And the West Ham boss at the time revealed he turned down a string of big name foreign stars to install Gary Breen at the heart of his defence.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, the thing that does, like, raise the cynic in me is Glenn Roeder talking about West Ham being linked with big-name foreign stars at that time. I would argue that Gary Breen was probably the biggest name being linked at that point.
Yeah, I'd like to see that list that Glenn had there.
I would have liked to seen the list. Yeah, that would have been useful. And I'm reading the entire article. Not seeing a lot of names being linked there.
No. Fabio Cannavaro and Nesta weren't the other options now.
No, unfortunately not. You know, I'll have to take
if Gary Breen had gone to Inter Milan, one of them might have rocked up at West Ham.
I mean, the alternative universe where Gary Breen, I suspect this would have been like very similar to the Robbie Keane situation, no?
Unless he broke in and had an absolute swan song. Who was the Nigerian fella that ended up at Inter?
Oh,
you know, championship manager legend.
Leave that one with me. It will stick with me. So I think Gary Breen, you know, goes on a free transfer to West Ham. His reputation is incredibly enhanced by the World Cup. Like, you know, genuinely, like, he had his medical on Inter Milan. You know, he was an individual who was linked with Barcelona after this World Cup. I would say outside of, you know, Duff and Keane, his reputation more than anyone else's is raised by this particular tournament.
Yeah, that's fair. Taribo West is who I was thinking of, by the way.
Ah, yes. What was the championship manager? We always started on a free transfer. That'll stay with me.
I can't remember, but all I know is he was at the two AC. He was at Inter Milan and AC Milan following a great tournament.
There we go. So we've talked about, I suppose, defenders who seem to be the most, you know, highly tipped, hottest prospects that anyone wanted to be linked with. Do we want to move on to, I think, maybe just some of the key players from here? Because there's not too many huge or shocking links, I think, after Gary Breen. I feel like he's really taking the cake here.
Well, Kevin Kilbane was next. He had a stellar tournament, and I think he deserves a lot of praise because he was massive in his versatility in Ireland in years going forward. But I suppose this is where it really started to show, because Duffer was playing up front. He was playing on the left. When Ian Hart came off, Kevin Kilbane would sit back a little bit. And we really saw that. And obviously, he's had that move from West Brom to Sunderland. And eventually, the following season, again, like a lot of these, it doesn't happen for him in 2002. Sticks around at Sunderland. In fairness, you could see why. There's a good core of Irish players at Sunderland at the time. He's playing very well for them. But then he gets that move to Everton, and like, that's a massive success for him.
Completely. And I think something interesting is, right after the World Cup, he's really linked with Aston Villa. So there's talks of a £5 million bid by Villa for Kevin Kilbane. Now, obviously, he'll stay and he'll go to Everton the next year for, I think, just about £1 million, give or take. But after the tournament in like July, you know, when it's sort of getting into silly season in terms of transfers, he's heavily linked with Aston Villa, and they are throwing around £4-5 million bids, allegedly, or, you know, reportedly, to try and get him over at Villa, which, again, given how, you know, he was Zinedine Kilbane at Everton, and I had that poster in my room. I'm not saying that tongue in cheek. I mean, he did so well at Everton for so long, you know, that it's interesting to think of what that alternative history would have been for his own career.
Yeah, if you'd have taken that Villa move, because, yeah, they're very similar clubs at the time, Villa and Everton, I suppose.
That's the thing. And you can see it at a certain level, yeah.
The next one I want to talk about is Matt Holland, because Matt Holland is someone who, obviously, his stock is very high after this tournament. He's proved himself some brilliantly against Germany. Again, Spain. I think Spain was his best game. Just bossed that midfield. He was brilliant. But Ipswich have just been relegated here at the end of the 2001-02 season. And I know he's captain, but his loyalty then, he stays for the full next season. He goes down and obviously gets his move to Charlton then in the summer of 2003. Yet again, another one of the Irish players who doesn't make the move until the following summer.
Timing is rarely a good thing for Irish people, though. You know, like, so the Irish aren't renowned for their timekeeping. At least that's what I tell people when I run late. And yeah, I think all of our players getting big money moves, or at least big important moves, the year after the World Cup probably speaks to that. But actually, funnily that you mentioned Matty Holland, because he's also linked with Villa, you know, in that period. And I think, as you said, Johnny, his stock's really high after the World Cup. I know Ipswich have been relegated, but, you know, the season before that, they finished fifth. And he's so integral in this, like, fairy tale run that Ipswich have had, pardon me. So it is, he, domestically and internationally, I think there's a lot of praise for him. So again, I think no surprise to see him linked with Villa. Surprise that he doesn't take advantage of it, arguably. There's also talks of, you know, move to Goodison Park for Matt Holland, and then West Ham are also in for him as well, allegedly. So I think that's just something, you know, there's a huge amount of talk, for want of a better phrase, of where these players can go. But I think all of these moves seem, aside from, and again, with the utmost, we're an Irish podcast. Obviously, we love Gary Breen. But aside from the Gary Breen one, everyone seems to be sort of at a level that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, them moves kind of, like, especially the West Ham one from Matt Holland, which would be nice because he obviously came through the ranks there. So being a West Ham youth player and getting that, like, I always get the sense with him that never really got a fair crack at West Ham. And I noticed the infamous talk about the Frank Lampard interview where he's sitting beside Harry Redknapp, and Matt Holland's been is one of the players mentioned by the West Ham fan that was moved on to make way for Frank Lampard. So you kind of almost get the sense that I wonder whether Matt Holland would have wanted to go back.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, and like, I think that's probably the one thing that Harry Redknapp returns to over and over again when people question his talent scout abilities. There is, though...
Keeping John Moncur there when he could have kept Matt Holland.
Disgraceful. Obviously, we're biased as an Irish podcast, but still, come on now. Again,
but he does eventually get that move to Charlton, and then he has four seasons as Premier League until they get relegated, but brilliant again then for Charlton too. So eventually he gets that move, but again, it's a year later, and it's probably the teams you mentioned, Charlton, are probably just that little bit of a level below, even though he manages to keep them in the league for three seasons running, and then the fourth, unfortunately, they go down.
I think something just to stress is, like, for a while, he's nailed on for Villa. Like, there's a article in the Evening Herald where it talks about Mark Kinsella and Matt Holland are going to be joined in the Aston Villa midfield next week when they complete their moves to Villa Park. Now, obviously, Kinsella does go to Aston Villa during this period, but there is a sense that this is going to be a sort of two-for-one act, you know, for Villa, that we're just going to pack our midfield with Irish players. And then there's also talk of, you know, maybe adding a few more Irish players back to Villa Park, which would have been a nice throwback to the early days of the Premier League.
Yeah, I suppose Kinsella gets that move in that summer, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. So 750,000 is what's reported in the Evening Herald.
Which is fair enough. Charlton, like, he's left Charlton, who were still in the Premier League at the time as well. It's a good move on paper for him. It doesn't really work out as well as it could have. But again, someone who his stock is high after this, he gets that move and he's happy out. I suppose the next one we should probably move on to is Duffer.
Yeah, and there's a great article, let me find it here, where it talks about the £50 million men. And this is talking just about Damien Duff and Robbie Keane. The Dublin duo who terrorised defences in the Far East last month have become two of the hottest properties in the game and are now set for lucrative, not luxurious, although maybe luxurious depending on Blackburn and Leeds, new deals that will elevate them into the Premiership's top earners bracket. So Duff and Robbie Keane, I think, outside of Gary Breen and his sort of ineffable links with Barcelona and Inter Milan, and I might actually just regen Gary Breen in FIFA later and put him in Barcelona's team. But apart from Gary Breen, these are the two hot prospects that come out of the squad. At the time, Graeme Souness has said, listen, Duff's market value is £25 million, which would be about €37 million at the time. So Duff would have been 23 years old. It's incredible to think of £25 million being €37 million. Hashtag Brexit. There's also talk of Robbie Keane. And it's interesting because Robbie Keane isn't, I say this as a Leeds fan and someone who loves Robbie Keane, he wasn't really important for Leeds anymore. Like, he talks about wanting to stay at Elland Road to prove himself to the new manager. And there's talk of Sunderland putting in a £9 million deal, €13 million pound deal for Robbie Keane at Leeds. Like, he's in the squad at Leeds, but he's not as important or integral to Leeds as Damien Duff is for Blackburn.
Yeah, well, I suppose, like, Duffer should have left Blackburn by now, whereas Robbie Keane's already had a couple of moves at this stage. I just want to stay on Duffer for a minute because he obviously doesn't go and he stays at Blackburn that summer despite all the interest. I think Liverpool is the one he's constantly linked with at that stage. So in that season, in the 01-02 season of the Premier League, he scored 7 at 32. And so in the 02-03 season, having not got a move, he actually betters that in less games and he scores. He gets 9 goals in 26 games. So obviously in that, he proves he's not just a flash in the pan, that this fella's the real deal. That's probably why he ends up getting that bigger money move to Chelsea then.
Well, I mean, you know, just speaking about that, Johnny, I think Liverpool is the one that people would remember. But, you know, there's talk in the Irish Independent of Man United making a final push for Damien Duff. So there's talks of Alex Ferguson swooping under Liverpool's nose to sign Damien Duff. Arsene Wenger and Arsenal are also linked with Damien Duff in 2002. Like, the big clubs are all there. And there's a really telling article in the Sunday Independent. It's just entitled, What Happened to Damien Duff? And they're wondering, like, why hasn't he pushed on to a bigger club? Like, they're saying this is jaw-dropping. You know, there's even a wonderful cartoon, and I'll put it up, and it's two men standing on a street corner and they're both Liverpool fans and said, what happened to Damien Duff? Where did it all go wrong? So, like, people are wondering what's going on. Declan Lynch says he's earning 40 grand a week kicking a ball for Blackburn, but he deserves better.
Yeah, I think loyalty is a big thing with him, and I know he's said in his career that he wanted to be loyal to Blackburn, etc. He'd come true, but Jesus, you've been loyal to them long enough after staying with them when they got relegated, when you had the chance to move. You did two divisions in the Championship with them. You've come up in the Premier League again and shown what you can do in that season. You've gone to a World Cup, been an absolute star. You've torn Spain to shreds. Now is your time to go. And I wonder, was it loyalty having come through the academy at Blackburn? Was it Graeme Souness that kind of put a stop to it, going, you're not going unless this was a too high evaluation? Because I can guarantee you one thing, if Damien Duff was English, Damien Duff would not have gone back to Blackburn Rovers at the end of that World Cup. No chance.
No, God, no, absolutely not. Like, it'd be laughable to even consider that, especially given how important he was in the World Cup. And again, to sort of go back to the, you know, what went wrong for Damien Duff, Declan Lynch, where he says, you know, when you're hot, you're hot. And Duffer at the time, and this is, you know, after the World Cup, was so hot he was thought to be contributing in a major way to the problem of global warming. And he's just saying, but I think Declan Lynch makes a really good observation for that period, where he's saying, listen, Duff, like, he's a young man, but he's not very young anymore. Like, we're mid-20s at this point. And he's saying, you know, Roy Keane had a decision when he was leaving Notts Forest, but going to Blackburn or going to United. And that was a really important decision, which dictated the course of his career. Declan Lynch at that point is saying, has Duff missed that decision? You know, where he had Liverpool, he had Arsenal, he had even United in firm, and Liverpool in particular being very serious. Does not pushing that through mean you missed the boat? Now, obviously, he will go and be signed for Chelsea, you know, not too far off of this. But I think that is something that is very important.
Yeah, I often wonder if Duffer had left, what his career would have looked like. Because although he was brilliant at Chelsea and Mourinho loved him, there is the sense that when he went to Newcastle, like, he was gone from Chelsea within 3 seasons. He'd won under Ranieri, then he had 2 seasons under Mourinho, where he won back-to-back Premier Leagues, was an important part of the squad. It was brilliant in the Champions League runs that Chelsea had. But again, then we went to Newcastle, it just didn't work out from up there for whatever reason. Obviously, he then has the rejuvenation under Fulham, that Fulham team under Roy Hodgson that gets to a UEFA Cup final where Duffer's brilliant. Like, there's a sense that had he gone to Liverpool or United or Arsenal around then, what would his career have looked like? And you can't say that he didn't make a wrong decision, because he went on, he won. He's probably, off the top of my head, he's probably the most successful non-Manchester United player in the Premier League from an Irish point of view. Having won a couple of League Cups, won the Premier League twice. Has anyone else won 2 Premier Leagues that didn't play for United?
No, I mean, if we're keeping in Premier League era, which is our bread and butter, yeah, there's no one else.
So again, it's one of them where I think he probably should have gone, but his loyalty kind of stopped. But again, would he have any regrets? Probably not. It's almost that sense of, some people talk about Wayne Rooney, like, despite the fact he's Manchester United and England's record goal scorer, maybe he did underachieve because there was a potential to win a Ballon d'Or. Whereas with Duffer, you're looking at someone who was in the team in a tournament that was phenomenal in them games against Spain, given a 9 out of 10. He tore with them fullbacks to shreds. I suppose maybe if there was links like Gary Breen had to Barca and Inter Milan, maybe that changes the narrative a bit. I just think because he's Irish, he's a little bit unlucky, because he should have got it. He's the one who should have got a move. And I know a couple of others that we've talked about don't get it for a year later. And it's almost like the summer of 2003 is the summer of Irish moves. But you're just so surprised that on the back of that World Cup, he doesn't get that move.
I mean, it's because Irish people have terrible timing. Like, I think this is very clear, Johnny. And I think something as well just to consider, and we might start to pivot to Robbie Keane, is probably the last big juicy story to talk about, is Blackburn's ability to say no at that period. And I know this is such a silly point to make, but Blackburn have no issue rejecting 15, 20, and eventually, I think it's reported, £25 million offers for Damien Duff. And the difference between Duff, who has a very high price tag, and Robbie Keane at Leeds, who, you know, will go on to Spurs for, I think it's £7 or £8 million, is Leeds need money. You know, and he could potentially be an important player. Like, Robbie Fowler has a hip injury, which would have opened the door for Robbie Keane to be a starter. But when Spurs come in, and it's not just Spurs, Sunderland are linked with Robbie Keane as well. Like, Leeds need the money. And there's even an Irish Independent article which talks about, you know, the cut price Keane set for Spurs move. And it says, you know, we all know that Leeds need to trim their wage bill, and they've agreed to take a £5 million loss on Robbie Keane to do so. And I think that's also of benefit for Blackburn.
And yeah, and I think with Robbie Keane's one, it's with the Robbie Keane one, he's had them couple of moves. So he's not afraid to make that step. And as you were saying, like Leeds were just buying people for the sake of it at the time. They'd gone through about six world-class strikers and world-class Premier League class strikers in the space of a year. They had like Huckerbee, they had Alan Smith, they had Mark Viduka, they had Robbie Fowler, they had Robbie Keane. There was that sense that despite his loan spell going well, perhaps the following season when he signed permanently, he was probably the one that was dispensable and that they could generate money for, as you said.
Yeah, and I mean, Terry Venables would say, like, you know, Keane did ask me to go. Like, so he did want to leave as well when it became clear the clubs were in for him. I think, interestingly, and again, going back to the Indo, yeah, they mentioned that, you know...
Which Keane is the opposite of, like, what Rob Crowley was talking about not wanting to go.
Yeah, completely. And I just, you know, something to consider when thinking about one of the reasons why Duff is in such high demand is there are very few players like Duff in the Premier League, especially left-footed players on the left side of the pitch. Keane in the Irish Indo does a good job of this where they say, you know, he's a bit unlucky. Like, Arsenal have strikers aplenty. United are operating off just three at that time, Van Nistelrooy, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, and a goal-shy Diego Forlan. But they're happy with what they have. And even Newcastle is very happy with the striking options that they have. So Spurs go in for him, Sunderland go in for him, he'll go on to Spurs. But like in one sense, he's sort of unlucky because a lot of the bigger teams that he could have jumped to, and no offense to Spurs, just aren't interested because they're already like well-serviced. Like they don't need desperately the type of striker that Robbie Keane is.
Yeah, exactly. Like no one's on the hunt for a goal poacher, as you said. Like United have Van Nistelrooy. They're probably playing a 4-5-1 at that stage as well. Like he's not going to get in at Arsenal ahead of Bergkamp, Henry, and Will Tord. Newcastle could have probably done with him as a. I suppose they're in. Who've they got? Shearer and.
Oh, that's a very good question. Who did Newcastle have? It would have been Shearer. It would have been.
Newcastle would be gone by then.
Well, we would have had the ever present. Shola would have been there, wouldn't he?
Shola, Lualua, maybe. Is that a little bit too late? Or not a little bit too early?
Craig Bellamy is definitely there. Let's have a look. I'll open it up. So we have Shola, who is just, you know, if you're thinking of Newcastle in the noughties, think of Shola Amiobi. Michael Chopra, yeah, Lemanu Lualua, Craig Bellamy, Alan Shearer, and Kyle Court. So yeah, like they do have a lot of riches there up front.
Yeah, they have multiple players. But I suppose, looking back into now, he's probably better than most of them, and Bellamy was more seen as a wide player.
You respect Shola Amiobi, or we end this podcast straight away.
If you're having Shola Amiobi over Robbie Keane, I don't think you deserve to be co-hosting this podcast.
That's probably a fair point, I won't lie. 7 under 21 goals for England in 20 appearances. I mean, come on, what more could you want? Is there anyone, I think, we'll maybe start to wind down. Is there anyone else you want to talk about as winners, or we move on to, I think there are two losers, and I don't mean that to sound as harsh as sound, that are probably worth discussing.
I think one more to mention just briefly is Stephen Reid, because Stephen Reid, like, was obviously used quite a bit in it, and he doesn't get his move from Millwall again until 2003, the summer, when he goes to Blackburn. So that's just another one I wanted to mention too.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And again, like, it's not really linked with anyone. Like, it's so funny because usually, as you say, Johnny, like, after the World Cup, there's this huge bounce, you know, or this huge interest in players. And yeah, there is a huge interest in players, but there's so few of them actually get over the line this season. It all comes the following season. Now, to be fair to Stephen Reid, he is pushing for a move at this point, but it just doesn't materialise. So I think that is just one thing to consider, that some players like Stephen Reid, like Robbie Keane, are actively pushing for moves, and others like Damien Duff, at least publicly, seem relatively content to stay where they are.
Yeah, that's a fair point, yeah.
In terms of losers, we've actually already talked about one of them, and that's Ian Hart, who just has a tough time at the World Cup. He's a scapegoat, fairly or unfairly. I think missing a penalty always makes you a scapegoat, just because it's a visual image that people can latch onto and say, if that had been different, we would have done well. He's also out of position for a few of the goals. He doesn't start well at Leeds that season, but Leeds don't start well that season. The wheels have well and truly come off. And going back to that article that I mentioned, like, there is that sense of him being a scapegoat domestically and internationally. And I think that would mark him as, I would say, an unfair loser of this tournament. But he is someone whose reputation seems to have been diminished by this, by the summer and then the early months of the next season.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. And I don't think he ever really recovers to the levels that he showed pre the World Cup.
No, I don't think so. And I think, you know, there's a lot more scrutiny on him. So I think it's a tournament that really should have been a chance for him to shine because he was bloody brilliant in the season leading up to the World Cup. But it is something that actually bizarrely sort of damages his reputation. Now, the other person that I want to mention, and it's a very obvious one, but clearly Roy Keane is a loser in this situation. And I say that because as someone who likes to put his head down and just focus on the football, literally the next 6 months is, and until he turns out again for the boys under Brian Kerr, is just about Roy Keane. Will he go back to Ireland? Is he too much of a hothead? Paul Hyland, September. Is Fergie in the same position as Mick McCarthy? Is Roy Keane? Is this all going to end badly? Blah, blah. Like, there is an asterisk to his name now about, is he going to implode everything and walk away?
Yeah, I think the one thing you'd have to say is not, like, he's missed out on his chance to get Ireland to a World Cup, to be the main man, to have a similar impact that you'd see, like, Gareth Bale for Wales, that kind of status. Like, you just don't associate Roy Keane, despite his phenomenal performance in qualifying to get us there. You just think more, you know, you think of Roy Keane versus Holland, you think Roy Keane versus Juventus, you think of them big games, and there's just that asterisk of what could have been in 2002.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's just important to say that from the start of the next season, people are expecting not just a Roy Keane bust up, but a huge implosion. Now, arguably, we do get that with the Roy Keane autobiography, which comes out and, you know, temporarily implodes his own career because there's the story with Alfie Inga Haaland in it, and that leads to disciplinary proceedings. But there is a sense in the newspapers that there is a baiting of Roy Keane, that, you know, we're waiting for the next big explosion, we're waiting for him to fall out with Fergie, we're waiting for him to do something on the pitch. So regardless of, you know, the experiences that he missed, I think it does blot his copybook, for want of a better phrase. Now, admittedly, in saying that, he does end the year with the number one bestseller in his book with Eamon Dunphy. But, I mean, what does money bring, Johnny? The struggling academic says. So I'll let you finish this out, Johnny. I think this has been a nice way of putting a yellow ribbon around the old oak tree, which was the 2002 World Cup. We probably will return to it in future episodes at some point because we'll never let it die. But I think winners and losers.
Yeah. I think winners and losers is a harsh way to describe it, because I think the whole campaign and what we did and everything, you'd have to end it on a high note. I think everything Ireland did in terms of qualifying, you have to include Roy Keane in that because he was such a crucial part of the qualifying process. I think the players did honourably. Like, it's like what Ireland always do. We overachieve where we're with, like, the sum is greater than its parts. But again, I'm going to have to say that if you want to tie a ribbon on it, then everyone's a winner.
What a wonderful sentiment to end it on. So thank you so much for listening to the boys we've seen. This has been a wonderful foray into the memory lane, especially the 2002 World Cup. Join us next week as we will be doing non-World Cup related content for the first time in literally weeks. So I'm very excited about that. Tell your friends, tell your enemies, tell your loved ones, and we'll see you next Monday.